Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. I always say that at the beginning, SMSF and Investor Behaviour. It's the weirdest title in the world. But this is a good one for SMSFs today. Investors always, but SMSFs in particular, because we've come out of the other side of reporting season. We've got a bit of clear air. ASX is looking really good at the moment. Dividends are coming in. Our investors at NAB Trade, and I know across the market, sitting on a lot of cash at the moment. And trying to work out how to position yourself, what to do with the cash that we've got and the opportunities that are sitting there. Today, I'm joined by Nathan Hughes from Perpetual Investments, who is a portfolio manager in Australian equities. He knows about this stuff, and he's been kind enough to make some time to share his thoughts on where we find ourselves now. Nathan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me, Gemma. It's a pleasure to be on.
So we just wrapped reporting season, and I won't say that all of our investors are super excited about it, but it is an interesting time. What did you take away from it?
You're right. It's an interesting time. It's a busy time for us. Look, I think there are a few takeaways, and I'd preface this by saying the way stocks move is always garnered by expectations going in. So with that in mind, I mean, revenues top lines were pretty resilient versus what people thought might happen. Certainly, we're seeing a lot of cost pressure still in the system, but some of those cost pressures have abated a little bit. So the inflationary impulse is probably not quite as acute as it was perhaps 6 months ago, but nonetheless, the pressures are still there. That's evident in things like wage inflation, for example, which is pretty sticky. And certainly across industrial companies, the cost of doing business is still on the up. Something else we saw was interest rate costs are still biting companies in terms of their debt funding costs. And there's a quirk of the new accounting standard, which I won't bore your listeners with, but interest expense on leases is going up as well, which can really impact the profit and loss statement. Look, the last thing that is really evident is just this threat of government intervention or regulation. You know, we're seeing calls for inquiries across a range of sectors, like in supermarkets. There's calls for inquiries in insurance as to pricing. Utilities are always a hot topic. So, I mean, that is something that feels like it's here to stay and companies under a lot more scrutiny. But look, on the whole, reporting season was actually pretty solid. Like, having said all that, the results were pretty much in line with expectations. We usually do see EPS revised down, typically. That's just a fact of life. But it was pretty benign this time around. So all in all, it was a decent month. And look, you saw that in the response from the market.
Yeah, it was pretty cool to see the market kind of bounce recently. And the question I think for so many people is, are we just following the US? Are we just going, yeah, oh, look, NVIDIA is doing so well, we should have a go at that? Or is it really being underpinned by results? And you feel like coming out of a reporting season, we've actually got a decent basis for it.
Look, definitely earnings are pretty resilient across our market. Look, I do think we are different to the US. Obviously, the US is being driven by NVIDIA and tech, and we've all heard about the Magnificent Seven. Look, Australia doesn't really have any comparables like that, but certainly I think a shift in sentiment. We saw when the market bottomed in October, November last year, there was a sentiment change toward interest rates. You know, people starting to believe in cuts, or certainly if not cuts, they were at the top of the rate cycle. And look, that's helped sentiment. So we've had a multiple expansion here as well. Whilst the drivers are probably not comparable, obviously if the US market's strong, it helps risk sentiment globally and helps all assets get a bit of a tailwind. But look, I think, you know, given population growth, immigration here, consumer resilience, I mean, there's good reasons to be relatively optimistic on Oz. The one caution I give is just some of those valuations now, post the move we've had, are probably getting, you know, on the richer side.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I'm going to ask you more about it. But let's just, one comment for those who would not be aware, you're an ESG manager. Can you talk us through how you do that on the ASX? It's not the kind of market, it's relatively constrained, top 200 companies anyway. It's not the kind of market that sort of lends itself to huge numbers of non-materials, non-energy sector stocks. How do you manage for that?
Yeah, great question. So, look, the way we do it, and there are a few different ways you can do it, there's really a spectrum of ESG in the market, whether it's more impact focus, very clear goals around sustainable development goals, for example, or at the other end of the spectrum, there's a pure checkbox exercise. And look, we're somewhere in the middle there. We're definitely not an impact manager. We do start with a negative screening process, but we add a bit of nuance around that as well. And look, the way this particular fund works is we exclude thermal coal, oil and gas, gaming and tobacco. So you're right, it does exclude a lot of the ASX 200, quite a bit of the index, which, I mean, has a few impacts for myself. Obviously, there are some constraints around the stocks I can pick. What it does do, though, is it pushes the fund towards a more mid to small cap bias. That's a feature this fund's had since its inception over 20 years ago, simply because many of the large stocks are uninvestable. Just to comment on some of the opportunities, I mean, the real transition stocks, a lot of them are found overseas. There are a handful here, but definitely opportunity set is broader overseas. I have the ability to invest overseas, but unfortunately couldn't find anything at a reasonable valuation. Having said that, a lot of the stocks that were, you know, topical have come off quite a bit. So something like Avestis, which was quite a well-known transition type stock, Ørsted, these are in renewable energy in Europe, for example. Tesla's probably not for us due to lack of profitability, but I mean, there are some things popping up overseas, but certainly in Oz, it's harder to find those pure transition plays. So really, we're just trying to make the most of the opportunities we've got and be able to pick stocks. So as I said, we typically skew away from the big end of town, because think your BHP, for example, or Woodside, no-go for us. There are a few things that the screen catches out that I think are probably good opportunities. So something like an Origin, I think, is a really interesting transition story. I can't own it in this fund, unfortunately, but I think that is that's probably the best play on the ASX for the energy transition moving forward.
Well, that's a really interesting comment. ESG is such an interesting area, and I find with investors, either you're a raging greenie and you've got very strong views on it, or you absolutely couldn't care less. I tend to skew to the left of that, but it's really interesting how investors tend to approach it. And it's good for people to kind of get a feel for what you do first. But also, I do know a lot of our investors, even if they're actually quite happy to hold all sorts of things, they are very much keen to participate in transition. They're looking for growth somewhere, and that's clearly such an extraordinary growth sector. You'd be mad not to at least have one eye on it. So for those things that you are looking at, Ben, what sectors do you feel at the moment, either post-reporting season or more broadly, have really outperformed lately? Either they're surprising you with their strength, or you think, oh, they've got a little bit more to run?
Yeah, I mean, so the sector that probably surprised the most, Gemma, was consumer discretionary, actually, in the month just gone. And part of that, I think, was this fear around people have run out of money to spend, the fixed rate mortgage cliff. Look, don't get me wrong, sales have moderated from 12 months prior, but certainly far less than anyone thought. So they were really resilient. Margins are really good. That was to do with shipping costs and obviously buying power. So in terms of supply side inflation, one quirk I've noted is that companies that are importing things from China have actually been getting cost relief on their actual cost of goods. And then when you combine that with shipping cost relief and resilient demand, then they've printed pretty good margin outcomes. I mean, that was a sector which did really well. And I think it surprised everyone, to be really honest. And when you look at the bank results as well, there's very little sign of consumer stress in debt, whether it's in mortgages or credit cards, personal loans, that sort of stuff. Look, the tech sector did really well. I think that's probably a function of, you know, some of the excitement around AI and data centers and indeed that link back to the US market. I think some of the moves probably a bit over the top in light of the actual earnings changes that we saw. But look, that seems to be that really seems to be flavor of the month. Just going back to the comments I made on the transition and the two stocks, which aren't investable for my particular fund, but I can talk to. I mean, they actually delivered pretty good results, Origin and AGL. So I think they're really well placed, and part of the reason for that is they have the customer load and the customer demand, which makes them a really integral part of the transition because they have the ability to underwrite the renewable development with that customer load. And they have the best sites in terms of proximity to existing transmission. You know, so the ability to build batteries, I think they're two companies that delivered good results and I think can continue to for the foreseeable future. Obviously, the very long term looks a little bit different for those two, but I think both of them are willing to put their money where their mouth is and develop quite a bit of renewable generation, whether it's on their balance sheet or partner with a third party.
What would make them renewable? It's not renewable. What would make them investable for you? What kind of tipping point is there for you guys to go, okay, good, we're allowed to get it now?
Yeah, so in particular at Origin, so my screen is around gas. So obviously it's quite interesting actually. As I mentioned, there's lots of different ESG funds and they all have slightly different restrictions. And I think what's really important for the end investor is just to understand exactly how the fund manager you're with or you're contemplating actually does do things. So it's not my job to tell you what's right or wrong, but we will be really transparent and clear about how we actually run our screens and exclude stocks for investment. And then the investor can decide whether they like that or they don't. So we're not trying to be cheeky. We're not hiding anything. We just have a very specific way we go about things. But the reason I guess I bring it up is because people's views are changing. There are some very direct and hard views out there, but there's also some, I would say, changing discussion around the role of gas as a transition fuel to get us through to the next stop because it is a transition. I think it's impossible to decarbonize, you know, in an instant without having some pretty dire consequences. So we need to think about how we're going to do that in the best way whilst ensuring reliability of power as well. But so, I mean, the fact that Origin does have an LNG business is what precludes it from being able to be invested in my portfolio, just to be clear.
Do you hold it in other portfolios?
We do across the firm, business? Yes.
Yeah, we do. So you're brought to you and go, guys, I really like it. I can't hold it, but you have it.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Look, yes. I mean, everyone, we have lots of different funds here, different PMs, different benchmarks. But look, we do, as a business, we do like the story, yeah. And
joy,
I would add
the joy of having multiple opportunities available.
Yeah, for an SMSF investor, I mean, it does offer a pretty nice yield at the moment too. And there's the possibility, so they've got an investor day coming up in the next few months, there's a possibility that they lift their guided payout range as well. It's going to generate a lot of free cash flow over the coming years.
There'll be a lot of people pricking their ears up at that, I suspect. Always the magic words, lifting their dividends. When we're looking at, you know, the companies and sectors that outperform, I find it really interesting you're talking about consumer discretionary as an area that's outperformed. And that's been noted a few times, again, because the outlook was so dreadful, I think, or people anticipated that it was, and then it sort of held up remarkably well. Do you think it will start to deteriorate now, or do you think those conditions will continue based, as you said, on really strong migration? We've got some sectors of the population that do extremely well with higher interest rates, even though lots of others are suffering. Is that the outlook now?
Yeah, there's definitely pockets of stress. I guess if I had a crystal ball, or if you asked me one, what's going to be the key driver, it all comes down to unemployment, really. Which has softened a little, but is still pretty, you know, it's a pretty resilient labour market at the moment. I think obviously you'd expect that to ease a little bit, but absent, I guess, a big shock where it deteriorates remarkably, it's difficult to see, famous last words, I guess, the consumer not just continuing to chip away in aggregate. As I said, there'll be pockets of stress and there'll be parts of the market that are doing far better than others. There always will be, but I think in aggregate, it ought to be pretty robust. And obviously a factor behind that is the tax cuts, which are coming in July. They're quite meaningful. And with the recent change from the government, they're probably a little bit more directed at those with a greater propensity to spend than save. So even though it might have been a subtle change, a change which got a lot of publicity, but impacted relatively few of the population for the, you know, the benefit of the majority, I mean, that's going to be a big boost to consumer incomes in the latter half of this year. So that's another reason to be relatively constructive on the consumer.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, not one we've talked about a lot. It'd be really interesting to see how much of the forward guidance has kind of anticipated that, particularly the change. As you say, it's very targeted toward the people who are probably under the most pressure currently and yep. therefore will be, you know, enthusiastic to have a little bit more money to spend. That might go quite well. Is there anything then that you were looking at in reporting season or, you know, in the subsequent week or two where you're like, oh, that looks really dicey. I'm very, very unsure about how this is going to play out, companies or sectors?
Yeah, look, I think I probably wouldn't categorise it as dicey per se, but a sector that's been really challenged of late and that was evident in the February results season was like healthcare services. So pathology is one where we've been invested in it. It hasn't worked. Hospitals as well. Hospitals, so Ramsay's the big listed hospital player. Trends are improving, but certainly not anywhere near the speed at which people had hoped coming out of a COVID world. So volumes have been slow to recover and they have had a lot of cost inflation, particularly in nursing, due to lack of availability of staff. We are seeing some improvement. So in terms of absenteeism is down a little bit more, volumes are continuing to come back. So it is improving, but certainly a lot slower than people have thought. So, healthcare services, as I said, pathology, also radiology, have just been a little bit slow to recover coming out of COVID. And when you have that volume growth, which isn't quite as you hoped, and costs are still going up, that's a pretty nasty recipe for margins. So that was pretty tricky. Absent that, there weren't too many things where you look at a sector and go, oh, that looks fairly ordinary. There was always stock-by-stock examples, but no real trends, I would say. I think I'm more concerned about some pockets of valuation rather than underlying how things are going. It's just that people may have gotten too carried away with some of the prices they're paying.
It's a stupid question. Is there any obvious or maybe not so obvious explanation for why volumes have been so slow to come back online with hospitals and pathology?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, in pathology, there's been a few drivers. So GP visitation has been down. Part of that is there's a few things. There was a telehealth took a lot of, I guess, share, if you like, of visits. That's sort of normalised a little bit. But we've also had a lack of availability of GPs. So people actually haven't been able to go and see them. Again, that's starting to ease. Obviously, I mean, look, many Australians have grown up just knowing bulk billing. And as some of, you know, GP visits have required an out-of-pocket payment, people are less likely to go. So there are a few other factors. In terms of hospitals, which is far more around elective surgery in the listed space, Ramsay, surgeons have been working less post-COVID, not working hard, but certainly less, a little bit more work-life balance. And I think it probably, in all honesty, did demonstrate some of the surgery is truly elective. There's certainly stuff that isn't and is absolutely necessary, but there are some things that people can defer or put off or maybe seek alternative treatment for. So, yeah, it's a really interesting thing because when you sit back and you look at the population growth we've had, you'd expect those volumes to come back quite strongly, and they are. I think it's just slower than people anticipated.
That's all so interesting. I find that fascinating. It reminds me of the old joke where someone goes to the surgeon and says, is this particular surgery really necessary? He says, may not be for you, but it absolutely is for me. Surgeon says it's very necessary.
Indeed. I did have that experience once, actually. I had a shoulder reconstruction a few years ago. To be honest, I found the surgeon pretty open. He was good and he said, look, you know, here are your options. It's not completely necessary. It'd be like the Warren Buffett saying, don't ask a barber if you need a haircut. But I found, yeah, mine was pretty good. He was good.
You got one of the good ones and he can afford to take a bit of time off.
Yeah, he did a great job.
It's, yeah, that's extraordinary. The other one, when you made the point about GP co-payments, my GP has been around quite a long time and said that when they introduced GP co-payments in the 90s, early 90s, and then subsequently got rid of them, part of the reason was that people were postponing GP visits for very small amounts of money, like $2 or $4. It was a really small amount even then. And he said he was seeing kids with perforated eardrums because the parents wouldn't bring them in for an earache and things would get dramatically worse. And when GPs were free, people would bring their kids in when they had an earache. It's one of the most awful stories I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, on quite a serious note, it's strange, I think, because people have been conditioned for it to be free so that unlikely to pay anything, but quite seriously and unfortunately what then you see through the health system is people get diagnosed at later stages and that can obviously have some pretty severe ramifications, but also for the costs, not only the patient but the costs through the system. So if someone presents far more unwell or it wasn't caught early, higher acuity, more treatment costs, it does have downstream impacts. So there's obviously the impact on the individual themselves, but then the cost to the system down the track. And so the pathology industry is actually lobbying for indexation at the moment. They haven't had it for nearly a quarter of a century. Look, our investment case, so we're in Healius, which has been a poor performer. We're still there. The investment case isn't built on hope of government intervention, but I do think they have somewhat of a reasonable claim because it is a vital industry, pathology, and it can, if you're catching things early, you can definitely reduce the cost to the system later on down the track. So I think it's a necessary industry. And like, I think, as I said, our case isn't built on getting that help, but it would be a nice kicker for the industry if they got some indexation assistance because they're not getting paid anymore for doing the tests, but their costs have certainly gone up.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. So you made a comment a little earlier that while, margins can look really healthy in some areas, we've also seen some multiple expansion, which for those who don't necessarily get in with the lingo means people are just paying more for the same stock.
that's the easiest way to put it.
Can we call it that? That's how I'm going to put it. People are just happy to pay more.
No, spot on.
Theoretically, because you think it's going to grow faster.
Yep.
But not always. Sometimes you're just happy to pay more because the alternative doesn't look that great. What are the areas that you feel the multiple expansion might be a little bit overdone?
Yeah, look, I think it's not a big sector here by cap weight versus, say, the US, but the tech, I think some of the tech names. And look, to be fair, these stocks have looked expensive for a while now. I mean, we did have a bit of a derate, but then in the last few months, that's just kind of disappeared. So big sales multiples or big earnings multiples, like stocks like a WiseTech, for example. Altium, though, I mean, Altium received a bid at an incredible price. I think it's around 18 times sales or 80 times free cash flow. I mean, they're just incredible numbers. But I think that sector is probably up there. And just reflective of sentiment being really strong. And you're absolutely right. It's just people paying more for the same set of earnings. And look, that's really driven by sentiment. When a stock's in the dumps and no one wants to own it, that multiple contracts. And we've seen a bit of that in pockets as well. I think just broadly, Aussie industrials, some of the more defensive names, their multiples are high. They're not off the charts, but they are high. And the reason I'm confident in saying that is because, everything's built off the risk-free rate and bond yields. And whilst bond yields have come off their peaks, they're still pretty elevated. And they're certainly elevated, well, that's a relative term, to say the last 5 years. And so you would think some of that would be reflected in multiples, but in pockets of the market just hasn't been the case.
One comment you made at the beginning of this conversation, and it's not something that we've really explored at all, is interest expense and how that is feeding into cash flow, how it's affecting businesses. I'm old enough to remember companies going to the wall and they didn't realize what the expenses are going to be. We've seen this just unbelievable increase in interest rates. I gave a personal finance presentation on Friday to a large group of people who work with very distressed consumers and people who are under a lot of financial pressure. And I made the comment, rates are not going back to where they were. Like, you know, we might see rates come off 100 basis points if you're lucky, but, you know, the days of 2% cash rate and, you know, your customers paying 4% are probably long gone. And they were quite shocked by that. And I was like, oh, I feel really old right now. For them, this is the new normal. You know, so, well, a year or two ago was the new normal. Now it's all a bit nasty. And companies, you wonder whether they have the corporate history and the knowledge to think about how their interest book is going to change over time. What are you seeing?
Yeah, look, I tend to agree that I don't think they're going back to zero or anywhere near there. I mean, where the neutral rate truly is and where it lands, I'm not qualified enough to make comment. I'm not a macroeconomic expert. But I think it's fair to say it's probably higher than zero. I think people, if you come into finance or you start investing at a certain time, you're certainly conditioned by the market environment in which you enter the game, if you like. And so a lot of people have been conditioned for rates at zero. And I think that's dangerous. I wasn't around, but I recall my old man telling me, you know, I had three jobs and my mortgage rate was 18%. Now, I'm not saying we're going there either, but it just does give you some perspective around, you know, the range of possible outcomes.
Look, so I have one of those too, by the way. My dad, I came home after watching Behind the News. If anyone remembers Behind the News at school, I think kids still watch it. And they talked about rates going to 18%. I came home and I said, Dad, I'm really worried about your mortgage. Was it like 7 or 8? I had no idea what I was talking about. And he said, it's okay, darling. We fixed it 13%.
There you go.
And he was really proud of himself.
That's pretty astute.
Yeah. He was all over it. Fixed
That's very
it
astute.
13.
And they do watch BTN now too. My young fella comes home and tells me about BTN. Anyway, I digress. Look, as a general comment, again, there's always exceptions, right? But as a general comment, balance sheets are reasonably healthy. However, if you do come from an environment of you've borrowed, I don't know, call it 1.5 turns of EBITDA, or that's to say, you know, your debt is 1.5 times your profit before tax and capex for the year, your interest cover might look really strong if you're paying 3% all in. All of a sudden, if you are paying 6 or 7 because there's a spread on the reference rate, that interest cover did deteriorate. It may not necessarily put you in a perilous financial position, but it certainly impacts your earnings. So that can be a big cut to earnings per share and a big cut, therefore, to things like dividends, for example. So it's just something we have to watch. I mean, Ramsey was a company which had ever-increasing interest costs. Some of those are a little bit tricky. The accounting is quite murky. I won't go into all the detail, but that's to do with a consolidated entity that they only own 52% of, but it impacts the full financials. But, I mean, that was a stock where the cost of debt has been quite problematic from an earnings point of view. So there are a few of them. Obviously, the highly geared infrastructure names, for example, it is a challenge and it can be a bit of a – you're always kind of chasing yourself a little bit because they've hedged it for a while, so they're not getting the full impact, but then the impact is still up. Next time the hedge debt rolls off or they have to refinance, the rate's just ticking up. And indeed, some of the REITs are paying what looks like all-in good rates today, but if they were to reset that today, then it'd still be a lot higher. So that's something just to keep an eye out for as well, because the interest coverage or the amount of times that their rent covers their interest costs is typically pretty low for those sorts of vehicles to begin with.
That's a really interesting one. Do you think the market's really processed some of the implications of it? Just hoping rates are going to come back to zero?
No, bit of column A, bit of column B. No, I think it's definitely better understood now. I think it was a bit of a shock 6 months ago in the August reporting season. I think it was less so this time. It's still there, but I think it's probably better understood. I just think some of the behaviour and some of the valuations suggest that people are pretty hopeful rates are going to get cut quite materially. Look, I think as I said, I'm not a macro specialist. We're probably closer to the top of the cycle, but I can't give you a strong view on whether they get cut 25 bips or 100. I'm not sure, because pockets of inflation do look a little bit sticky. So it's hard to say, but I think some of the behaviour, there's definitely that hope that the cuts are going to be pretty meaningful pretty soon.
Yeah, I would say the same at both the household and the corporate level, and it's interesting to observe. As I said, yeah. It just makes me feel old more than anything else. Like, wait a second, we didn't start here. This is crazy. So you have your portfolio.
Yeah.
You're looking at what's been coming in. Any areas that you're kind of starting to get a little bit more interested in that you might not have looked at previously?
Yeah, so we're bottom-up investors, so we're probably not looking for themes or whole sectors. Although having said that, you know, sectors do wade in and out of favour kind of together. Stocks within a sector. So something that, does look interesting is lithium. Something we haven't been there in a big way and certainly not in my fund. I mean, my fund can invest in certain metals. So just to, I guess, cover off on the screens, I can own certain commodity stocks. Obviously, there has to be a strong argument for the ESG credibility of that investment. And it's not just the metal, but it's also the way the company conducts itself and goes about it and their track record. So they're all things that we think about. So lithiums are possible. And just given how out of favour it is, it at least warrants doing the work. Look, other bottom-up stuff, I've been buying shares in a software company called Hansen Technologies, so stock code's HSN. And look, I guess a good case in point around how we do things here and how I like to think, I like to look for good quality companies that are a little bit out of favour. And what happened with Hansen just very recently was they made an acquisition. It was a small business in Germany, which the acquisition that they bought looks like it's going to lose money for a couple of years. And look, that shocked the market. However, this is a business and a management team with a strong track record of M&A over their listed life. It's a well-considered acquisition, and they're prepared to take on that short-term pain for the prospect of long-term gain. And I'll be honest with you, that's actually pretty rare on the ASX and certainly in small cap land. Importantly, if that investment doesn't work out, their balance sheet is still really strong and the core business is going pretty well. And this is actually it's a small bite. So it could be a loss of some money, but in the context of the broader Hansen group, it's actually not terribly material. So that was a really good opportunity where I thought the market overreacted. They're a bit scared about the acquisition losing money because that, generated near-term EPS downgrades, which no one's allowed to have. But it gave us a good opportunity to buy some shares there. So, yeah, rather than looking at big sectors or big sways of the market, we really try and pick the eyes out of stock-specific stuff. Often we can be a little bit early, but, yeah, we tend to find those decent businesses that are a bit unloved, they're the places where you can make decent money over on a 2 to 3 year view.
So one last question then. That's a cool story, by the way. I have to go and look at it now. it's dividends. So this is where the SMSFs come into play, right? Yep. So our guys tend to be, and I made this comment to a journalist the other day, almost agnostic as to share price moves, right? They're there for the divvy and they're very happy to hang on to it. So long as the divvy doesn't get cut and the share price falls, right? Nobody wants a falling knife. We don't want any yield traps. But they're very, very happy to sit around, watch the price go up and down and just take their check, right? Very comfortable with that. Anything that you're seeing in that space that's really appealing at the moment?
Sure. Look, I'd echo that. You've got to be very careful in terms of know what you're buying, because you don't want to look at a really nice yield and then have that yield get cut because the earnings are unsustainable. But two stocks that probably stand out in my portfolio that fit that bill where I'm quite confident in the resilience of them are Deterra Royalties and Macmillan Shakespeare. So Deterra is a royalty on an iron ore mine run by BHP Billiton in the Pilbara. Interestingly, from an ESG perspective, it's some of the highest quality stuff in the market. which is good from a downstream emissions standpoint. So it means the product is sought after, but Deterra just clips the ticket. There is risk on price, obviously. There's a risk on iron ore price, but they are still growing volume over the next 12 months, which will mitigate some of that. And look, I think the valuation is pretty reasonable in terms of price expectations there for the long run. Plus, there's every chance that in the fullness of time, that volume will grow. It's a big tenement. There's more in the ground. And I suspect BHP will try and maximise that and Deterra will clip the ticket. But look, as it stands today, that's yielding probably 6.3% fully franked. And the other is McMillan Shakespeare, which is a novated leasing salary packaging company. Really nice business model in that it's capital light. So they don't need to deploy capital to grow, which of course means they can pay out a large portion of their earnings as dividends, and that is yielding over 6% fully franked as well. So, I mean, there are a couple of examples where over and above the dividend, I like the businesses. They've got strong balance sheets run by good people and pretty reasonable valuations as well.
Just the kind of stories everybody likes, right?
Absolutely. wish I had more of them.
Yes, yeah, so a few more of those wouldn't do any harm at all, yeah. Would they? Nathan,
No, I was just going to say, I mean, just given that valuation expansion that we've had, I mean, some of the yields have compressed. And so I think the real standouts are a bit harder to come by at the moment. I mean, there are a couple, and there are some others which are perhaps not yielding big numbers. Like, again, I actually think the boring old Telstra is in not a bad spot at the moment. The yield's not quite as high as it used to be, but I think that business is going pretty well. And there was a bit of concern at the result over one small division within the entire group, which disappointed the market. I think the reaction since has been a little bit of an overreaction, because you've got a leading mobile business which is doing really well in a rational market because their competitors are constrained. And everyone seems to have forgotten, you know, a pretty unique and valuable portfolio of infrastructure assets there as well, which will continue to grow. It's got some CPI protection in there, and they're actually rolling out some new fibre for some data centre customers. So I'm confident that business will continue to do well. So even if the yield's perhaps not as high as it used to be, I think the business is pretty well placed, and it's been a laggard actually in recent months. So I think that's not bad buying either.
It's been a long, long time since we've talked about Telstra. There'll be people going, wait a second, I haven't heard about this one for a while.
Yeah.
Nathan, where do people go to find out more about you, about your fund, about what you're working on? Where do they go?
Sure. So we're up on the Perpetual website, obviously. So the name of the fund is the Perpetual ESG Australian Share Fund. Something that's a little bit unique about this product within Perpetuals, we also have a listed version. So the stock ticker there is GIVE, G-I-V-E. Just very quickly, the idea there is it's a lower base fee product with a performance fee, and we give a share of that performance fee to charity. So we've done that once. The fund's pretty new. We made our first donation 6 months ago. It was only a small amount, but it's something that I'm proud of, and obviously we're looking to grow over the fullness of time. And, of course, the last thing is LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, and I post all my quarterly newsletters up there as well if anyone wants to have a read.
That's awesome. And I think the GIVE concept is really cool. People will want to look into that.
Yeah, thank you. It's very small at the moment, but something that we're obviously aiming to grow and so I feel strongly about. So, yeah, hoping it continues to do well from here.
Awesome. Nathan Hughes from Perpetual, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
Thank you so much for listening. Also, as always, we love hearing from you. We get fantastic feedback from you guys. Love getting your questions and guests you'd like to hear more from. Please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.